Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Modern Love will be back with brand new episodes in 2019, but today we're bringing you a playlist of our favorite holiday episodes, so let's get started. Remember that time you wanted your significant other to be more romantic? Writer Cindy Shupak says, be careful what you wish for. Pamela Adlon, star of the FX comedy series Better Things, reads Cindy's essay, In Marriage, Beware of Big Boxes.
In any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a day when you wonder why you married this person. It's hard to fathom at your wedding, this handsome tuxedoed man is publicly binding his life to yours, and you think, it would have to snow inside my house before I would ever feel anything but love for this man. Well, it snowed inside my house. I'm not saying that metaphorically. I am telling you it snowed inside my house. Because a few years ago, to kick off the holiday season, my husband Ian decided, even though we didn't have kids yet, even though I never said I miss snow, that I would enjoy a snow machine. And it wasn't flaky snow. Not that I would have enjoyed flaky snow, but Ian did admit later he thought it would be flaky. That's the problem with ordering things like a snow machine online. You never can be sure if the snow will be just mildly annoying or marriage-ending annoying. Instead, the snow was sudsy, like a washing machine was overflowing in our upstairs loft and spewing suds down into the living room, where I was flipping through a magazine in front of the fire, having been instructed not to peek while Ian set up the big surprise. I have to admit, I had a bad feeling about the big surprise. It came in a big box, and there's not much I can think of that a woman would want that comes in a big box. Chocolate and jewelry come in small boxes. Clothes come in relatively small boxes. They say good things come in small packages. I say bad things come in big boxes. So, I was prepared for something I might have to feign excitement over. A new drum set for Rock Band. I'm on the fence about whether it's polite or stupid to feign excitement over a gift from your spouse. On the one hand, you want to reward his efforts and encourage future gift giving. On the other hand, that's the kind of flawed thinking that leads women to fake orgasms with men who have no idea where the clit is. And those men have no idea they have no idea. That's the danger of faking. But I didn't have time to fake a response. I had a genuine response in a voice I barely recognized that shrieked, "What the hell is happening?" Let me tell you what the hell was happening. The snow was accumulating on the floor and landing in giant clumps on the rug, coffee table, leather chair, and walls. Real snow does not land on a smooth vertical surface like a wall. But this snow did, until it slowly started to slide down, leaving a thin, wet trail in its wake, like a snail. I finally yelled, "Stop! Stop, stop, stop! Turn it off!" And amazingly, That was the first moment Ian realized the expression on my face was not joy, but horror. He turned the machine off and explained that the snow was non-staining and non-toxic and could simply be vacuumed up, which would have been nice to know earlier, but I guess that would have ruined the big surprise. I was beginning to think the big surprise was that Ian didn't know the first thing about me. Did I mention the housekeeper had just finished cleaning? I love a clean house. Ian certainly knew that about me. Maybe he thought the house would be super clean after this veritable indoor car wash. But instead, it looked like a rave had happened in our living room. And I said as much. In fact, I think I said more. And that was the moment I realized the expression on Ian's face was not remorse, but disappointment. And he was not disappointed in the snow machine as I felt he should be as a consumer. He was disappointed in me. He had imagined us dancing in the snow. He was still looking down at me from the loft when he confessed this, so we were kind of a reverse Romeo and Juliet in more ways than one. Ian does not abandon a plan easily, so he smiled and said, "Come on, babe, one dance." And then he turned the snow back on and hurried downstairs, still hopeful the evening could be salvaged, maybe even made romantic. And I thought, what if this is one of those moments, like the night we officially moved in together in New York? Ian wanted to eat Chinese food sitting on boxes, and I wanted to unpack the boxes, and he finally said he was going to a bar if I wasn't going to be fun. And I worried I might not always be fun, and what then? Of course, the next morning, our first Monday waking up together in our new home, I regretted everything. Why was I so concerned with unpacking that I couldn't enjoy our first night in our first joint apartment? That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So I told Ian I thought we should have a certain number of do-over days in our relationship. We should each get, say, 3 days that don't count against you, no matter what you do. And Ian said, "Great, see you on Thursday." Okay, that was funny, but the truth is, you don't get do-overs. Certain moments in life never come back, and I worried that maybe Ian's winter wonderland was one of them. So I tried. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, but I tried to smile and dance with Ian in the snow. Until 2 seconds later, when my shoes started to slip and slide in the suds and I was getting faux snow in my hair, and I screamed, "I can't do it!" And as I ran outside, all I could think was, "Why did I marry this person?" I imagine Ian was standing inside in the snow thinking the same thing. And it wasn't like in the movies. We never looked at each other and started laughing hysterically. The whole night was really kind of terrible, especially during the cleanup process, which was, in fact, a process. First of all, I was surprised that I was expected to help, but I decided to pick my battles. I did not, for example, point out that the bubbles did not simply vacuum up. The vacuum mostly just pushed the bubbles around. But we did get into a disagreement about whether something can be for indoor use only. This happened because I suggested that perhaps having snow outside of our house may have been a way to go. I could have come home to the one house in Los Angeles that had snow. Or he could have put the snow machine on the roof. And then, while we were sitting by the fire, he could have pointed out the window and said, "Look, it's snowing." "It's for indoor use only," was his response. "Nothing is for indoor use only," I said. "If you can use it indoors, you can use it outdoors, unless it's so poisonous it would kill animals, and then it shouldn't be used indoors either." We finally agreed to disagree on that one, but I did have to admit that the stains on the chair and wall miraculously disappeared, to which Ian replied dryly, "It's not miraculous, it's non-toxic and non-staining." Finally, as if readying it for burial, Ian placed the snow machine back in the big box between two containers of bubble refill, which were, to my surprise, under the bathroom sink, where Ian had already stashed them for, I guess, the next time we wanted snow in the house. And then he said he would give the snow machine to someone at work who would appreciate it. I had to bite my tongue to keep from asking, who would that be? Someone who hates her house? As we carried several large trash bags of bubbles outside to the trash, Ian reminded me that sometimes I love his grand gestures. I couldn't remember one I loved until he said, when I proposed on the beach on a horse. I admitted that was a good one, maybe because the horse wasn't in our living room. But that's the thing about romantics. Don't romanticize them. They can be hit or miss. As it turned out, there was a woman in Ian's office who had two toddlers and a linoleum kitchen, and the kids and her husband loved the snow machine. In fact, they had so much fun, they invited more children to enjoy more snow on Christmas Day. So maybe the gift was just early. Several years and one linoleum kitchen early. And it is not lost on me that this gift ended a hard year when Ian and I got further from, not closer to, having children of our own. But it was also a year, despite our indoor snowstorm, that Ian and I got closer to, not further from, each other.
Pamela Adlon, reading Cindy Shupak's essay, In Marriage, Beware of Big Boxes. Cindy actually suggested that her husband Ian join her in the studio when we talked to her. 13 years together hadn't dulled his commitment to keeping things interesting, but that doesn't mean they agree on all of his choices. The latest episode was still pretty fresh. Ian turned 50 and wanted to do something special, something different.
There was an incident with some Thai wish balloons. And I guess we should explain our history with these Thai wish balloons, which was kind of romantic, which is how all these things start. So when we were trying to have a baby, which took 5 years of sort of trying everything and lots of heartache and disappointment, and we finally adopted our daughter, Olivia, who we're madly in love with, and she's 5 now, almost 6. Anyway, we had been in Thailand and on one Valentine's Day, and we had lit this wish balloon, which is kind of a tradition there, this giant balloon, and it has a flame underneath it, and you light it, and you make a wish, and it goes up into the sky and goes and goes and goes until it disappears. Anyway, so Ian has since found on the internet where all these...
Every romantic gesture can be recreated with a little bit of internet research. It can be done in the privacies of your own home.
And sometimes outside your home would be better. Anyway, on his birthday, we were out on the beach, which seemed perfectly safe, with a bunch of friends, and he was lighting them. And I was totally game, right? I tried for a long time to block the wind and help him light it and set it off. But then it didn't, so we were walking back to our house, and we passed through this alley that's between condos. And I guess
I'm not letting go.
And it was, I didn't know he wasn't letting go, but suddenly I turn around and he and his friends are trying to light this wish balloon away from the wind. And it does light, and it lifts up and lodges itself into the balcony of an apartment.
For 2 seconds and comes right back out.
It felt longer than that.
It popped out.
It was not 2 seconds.
And I would have been up there in like 30 seconds.
How would you have gone up there?
There was a staircase then. It would have been fine. And it's like a closed balcony.
And then it got worse because it just lodged. Which seemed miraculous, like, oh, somehow Ian manages to get through these things and I shouldn't worry, and then lodged itself into power lines, which...
Coated power lines.
Oh my God, I seriously had an image of the whole, of everything exploding.
Despite all the laughing now, the snow machine incident came at a very hard time, when Ian and Cindy were trying everything to get pregnant.
The baby thing, as hard as it was, we were either on the same page or respectful of whatever the other needed, if we needed a break, or, and that seemed endless. Ian really wanted a child as soon as we got married, which is, I think, why men get married a lot of times. It's like men who are happy with their lives, but what you might want to finally settle down and marry when you want a baby. So he really was ready to have a baby, and it took us such a long time. And he was very respectful of the time I needed. So in that case, we were really on the same page, and the snow machine really did stand out as kind of a moment where we were just on totally different pages. I think that's why it felt maybe so dire.
With these gestures, you never really have time to, you know, practice them or...
Why not?
Know, because that would totally destroy the moment. It
yeah,
was for
I
you.
Guess so.
And it
You're
was
right.
like, that was okay. it. So it was cute. And what's it, the worst thing that would have happened was, you know, we would have gotten some sud stuff on our clothes for 2 seconds, but it was a great idea.
Many people, after that Modern Love piece came out, wrote on the New York Times Facebook site and in comments that I was just ungrateful and didn't deserve this guy and what a romantic thing. And there was a lot of that. I think all the people who agreed with me maybe just sat quietly and were grateful they didn't have a snow machine in their house. But the people who thought I didn't deserve Ian and that I should have enjoyed it were boisterous. So that was a little just interesting and gave me pause.
Not educational? Not educational at all? Just interesting? Informative, maybe? Just guessing? I don't know. Toss it out there. Still, I mean, I'm glad I did it. I'm glad she wrote the essay about it. I'm glad we're still laughing about it. And chances are I'll do it again or something very, very
similar.
No, it'll
similar. Be something very different. It'll be something I'm completely unprepared for. That's the beauty of it.
I love doing this kind of stuff. It cracks me up, and that's great fuel, and they're really fun to do.
And I would say, I know when I was... When I was single for a long time and didn't marry until late in life and had kind of what I thought was already a big life that I loved and traveled and had friends, and I really felt like I didn't want to marry someone unless it would make my life bigger. I would be forced to grow, and, you know, I think I asked for the snow machine in a way. I deserved the snow machine, and I wouldn't have really, in retrospect, wanted a life with Ian without it, because it's a big part of our story, I guess.
Cindy Shupak and her husband, Ian Wallach. Cindy's credits include Divorce, Better Things, Modern Family, Sex in the City, and Everyone Loves Raymond. She's also written 2 comic memoirs, including The Longest Date, Life as a Wife, from which this Modern Love essay was excerpted. More after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
When a loved one becomes very ill, it can shift your perspective on love and family in surprising ways. For Lee Newman, her father's failing health turned an ordinary family hunting trip into an unexpected lesson about hope. Actor Darby Stanchfield of ABC's Scandal reads Lee Newman's essay, A Family That Takes No for an Answer.
Every year, my far-flung family gathers for Christmas at my parents' house in eastern Idaho, along the Snake River, where the snow falls with thick, dreamy, often relentless abandon. Last year it had been falling for almost a week. The day before Christmas Eve, as flakes continued to drift down and the afternoon light dimmed, my father suggested we shoot some ducks for dinner. Who wanted to go? My husband Lawrence did. He was new to the Western ethos of hunting your own food. And I wanted to go, too. Even though I was 5 months pregnant, if only to distill any ideas my family might have about my now being a wimpy New York City pregnant lady, capable only of sitting in a rocker ordering BPA-free baby bottles online. Off we set, throwing on parkas and hauling out shotguns. The route down to the river is a narrow quarter-mile walk through cottonwoods. The fresh drifts came up to our thighs. We lumbered along, our spaniel, Tori, nosing ahead. 10 yards before the bank, Dad motioned us down with his glove. We hit the snow, peeking through thickets of ice branches to scout what lay below. We crossed a semi-frozen knee-high section of the river, climbing up a narrow gravel island. Already my hands were numb. I hadn't dressed properly. My gloves were fingerless, and I had skipped the snow pants. Just on the other side of the island, a small flock of ducks, plus several Canadian geese, were fussing in the bent, crackling reeds. We crouched down. "Don't hit anything that flies," Dad said. "They're right near the shore where we can get them. Tori won't swim in this cold." All of a sudden, they took off in a squawking flurry, flying across the white sky. Law squeezed off a shot and missed. I held tight a few seconds longer, but also missed. Dad, however, displaying his old-school finesse, waited for just the right moment and brought down a goose that tumbled directly into the water. Away it rushed with the current. I looked at Dad. He looked at me. I knew why he'd taken the shot, as did he. Every goose seems like the last he'll ever shoot, and it may very well be, at least with his daughter watching. "Well," he said, "that was something to be ashamed of." "Don't worry," Law said, handing me his gun and taking off running. "I'll get it." Law, of course, was the only one among us with strength to follow the goose. I was too slow and huge and was carrying my grandfather's heavy double-barreled shotgun. And Dad could no longer run at all, not at age 65 with his two hip replacements and damaged heart. We watched Law sprint down the bank. There was something teenage in his step, something raw and gleeful and almost obsessed. His hat flopped off, his figure bounded over the deep snow. Painfully, slowly, Dad and I began to follow, foils to Law's progress, not just in our movements, but in our mindsets. Dad and I come from a pessimistic family, a family that on his side has seen more than its share of suicide, alcoholism, manic depression, and premature death. Luckily, the two of us had escaped those routes. But if you asked us, for example, if we thought the experimental drugs Dad was trying might help repair his heart, we would say no, probably not, and change the subject to snowblowers or recipes for pheasant cacciatore. The economy? About to implode and leave us destitute. My youngest brother? His flight was never going to make it into Idaho Falls in this storm. No matter the situation, we believe it's better to say no and believe that no. That way you can't be disappointed. 5 years ago, the day my father told me he was dying, he stopped the truck along a highway in the Rockies and said, "Look, I've got a 22% chance of making it through the next 2 years." He just wanted me to have the scientific facts. I cried a little. There in the truck, he cried, and we never talked about it again. Most of the time, I actually forget about Dad's health, except when I notice he is panting from a 10-second walk. Or when he shot a goose that we couldn't bring in. Now we were stumbling along, Dad in front, trying to follow in Law's deep boot prints, our eyelashes gunked over with flakes, our breath turned labored. We stopped every 15 steps, bent over to rest. Law had to be at least half a mile ahead, out of sight. "You don't think he'll get that goose, do you?" Dad asked. "No. No, unless it hit an eddy and somehow washes up." But secretly, I allowed myself to believe Law might. There was a reason for that. 7 years ago, 3 months after Law and I married, I called it quits. I was burning up with anger over issues large and small, all the messy, unresolved stuff that had been pushed aside as we planned the wedding, only to flare up after. So I left him with the wedding china and salad spoons in our cozy apartment in Manhattan and moved into a small carriage house in Massachusetts, where I had enrolled in graduate school. We already had our serious problems, I told him. Therefore, we were over. Law took the news with a kind, understanding, broken expression. He agreed that our marriage was, indeed, over. Then he proceeded to ignore that, even when I announced it to my friends and family, even when I asked him to file for a separation. He continued to come up to visit me. He continued to plan my visits down for weekends and school vacations. He seemed to accept, in theory, that we were separated. Yet all of his actions suggested an absolute denial of everything I had expressed and he had agreed to. This should have enraged me further. I was not being listened to. And yet it didn't. His pretending let him believe I hadn't left the marriage, and oddly, it let me pretend I hadn't left either. Once I realized that I didn't really want to leave, that I wanted to stay and fix our problems. He's never going to get that goose, Dad said, and I don't think I can go on much further. Dad did not look good. As for me, I wanted to lie down in the snow, not an excellent indicator for wilderness survival. Why doesn't he give up? My father asked. I don't know, I said, and I didn't know. I tell you what's got me worried, Dad said. What if he tries to get that goose and falls in somehow? Then we're going to be in real trouble. I cupped my hands and shouted, Law! Down the bank. Nothing. The sky flushed and darkened. We waited for a half hour. We looked for any footprints doubling back to the house. More and more, I started seeing the scenario Dad had laid out. What if Law was so sure of himself that he did think he could get that goose? What if he leaned down to pull it over with a branch and fell in up to his thighs? The water would rapidly turn him hypothermic. Oh, I felt sick. I walked faster. So did Dad. We lacked flashlights, snowmobiles, cell phones. When we were a few miles from the house, Dad said, I think you better go back to the house and call the sheriff. I'll keep going along the bank. We unloaded the guns, leaving two of them by a tree. Dad kept going up the bank. I slung my grandfather's gun over my shoulder and headed home through the woods, panicking, stumbling through untouched snow that now came up to my waist. My stretched belly hurt with every step, and on top of it all, I couldn't remember the way. We had gone so far downriver that I wasn't sure where the house was. Until I finally saw our windows shining through the trees. I started yelling, Anne! My stepmother came out and helped me inside. Lawrence was just here, she said. He doubled back from the river. You guys must have just missed each other. I wanted to laugh. If Law had gone the other way around the house, I would have seen his tracks. If I had gone the other way, we might have run into each other at the door. Everything at that point should have just been chalked up to a silly scare due to bad communication and luck. Except that Dad was still out there, alone. I waited by the fire. About an hour later, the two of them came back. Law had done lap after lap to find Dad, who, though exhausted, had remained on the trail of Law, and bringing him home along with our abandoned guns. That night, as we lay in bed, Law turned over. You didn't really think I was stupid enough to dive into a frozen river in the middle of a blizzard, did you? I wasn't sure what to say. It wasn't stupidity that I thought might have inspired him. It was hope. Law knew Dad felt badly about killing the goose, and he believed he could fix it, even as that goose floated faster and faster out of reach. What's the difference between hope and denial? I wanted to ask him, does it hurt or help to pretend your father might go on living, even if all facts say he won't? If our marriage, a sturdy, surprising, wonderful marriage, gets into trouble again, will it help or hurt if we pretend it's okay and push blindly on the way we did last time? What does refusing to see the grim side of the truth do? Smash down issues we'd be better off confronting, or keep us from sinking into premature, unnecessary defeat? Oh no, I said, turning off the light, curling up with him in the snug log cabin dark. I knew you'd have the sense to turn back eventually. Just as I knew and appreciated that he lacked the sense to stop himself from chasing it in the first place.
Darby Stanchfield, reading Lee Newman's essay, A Family That Takes No for an Answer. After 14 years of marriage, including the 2 years of separation, Lee Newman and her husband Lawrence have 2 children and live in Brooklyn, New York. She says those 2 years of separation made a lasting impact.
All of those strange things that happened in our past, I think they might have prevented a serious period of questioning later on in life. Probably where I am now, where I see a lot of my friends, you know, go through really hard times in their marriage after 10 years. But I had my breakdown about marriage so early, it was like a pre-breakdown, that it excised a lot of the demons and a lot of the real terrors I had about marriage. And I think also when you go through a really, really hard time, you're changed by it. You're more generous with others. I think it made me a better wife.
And what about her father? 11 years ago, during that hunting trip, he was near death with a failing heart.
My dad heard about a clinical trial where they'd put a pacemaker in your heart, and he was not eligible for the clinical trial. And so he took his own money and went to a hospital and asked them to put a pacemaker in and paid for it out of pocket, which was an extremely expensive gamble on his own life. And it worked fantastically on him. That particular procedure is supposed to stop deterioration of the heart. And in his case, it actually reversed the condition somewhat. So he's in terrific health now. After several years, the whole thing went away.
So has that changed his attitude about life?
No, I think my dad's pretty negative still. Yeah, he's very pessimistic. And there are times when I talk to him and I just have to guard myself. There can be a brighter way looks at things, or there is a possibility that it won't end up terribly. I also think that when he talks to me, he's sometimes worried because I'm his daughter, and he wants to protect me from whatever I'm talking about. So if I say, oh, I want to buy a house, he'll go, oh, my God, what if there's a flood? You know, what are you going to do if the toilet breaks? You know, and I think, well, I'll fix the toilet, Dad. It's okay. I'm going to get a house. You know, I'm in my 30s. I've got kids. I need to get a house now. And he doesn't mean it. You know, he's just doesn't want me to have to go through hard things, just like any parent wouldn't want any child to do that.
But Lee says that pessimism isn't always bad for you.
If you can walk that line where you are prepared to deal with the worst outcome and you know what it is, it can be quite helpful. It can be quite grounding. It's just you have to be careful that you don't drown in your own terrible outcome before it's even come to pass. And I think I have a tendency sometimes to hope for the worst just so that it'll be over with and be sewn up and then I can recover and move on rather than sitting around really not knowing what to do. And I think that's a condition that a lot of people struggle with. And it's a shame. It's a shame. I'd like to be different. I'm working on that.
Writer Lee Newman. Her memoir about growing up in Alaska is Still Points North. Another story coming up after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
For some people, New Year's resolutions are all about going to the gym, saving money, decluttering. That's not Christine Lloyd.
I looked for the really bizarre. I thought, you know, I'm not just going to do little bitty fearful things. Let's just go off the deep end here.
Christine wrote about her resolution in her essay, In the New Year, More Cuddling. It's read by Margarita LaViva, who plays Abby in the HBO show The Deuce.
Attending a cuddle party was one of my fear-conquering New Year's resolutions for 2016. My other resolutions, I had a long list, included speed dating and taking a hike with a mountaineering club. I never got around to speed dating or hiking, but by August, I had worked up the courage to sign up for a cuddle party. And that's how I found myself lying in a foam pad on a stranger's floor with my head on the shoulder of a strange man. Strange in that I didn't know him, of course, but also strange in that he was so thin and bony that cuddling with him was no comfort at all. Soon a young woman settled in on his other side and asked if she could hold my hand. Okay, I said feebly. We reached out and clasped hands across the man's chest. I felt rigid, tense, terrified. A sea of foam pads and quilts and stuffed animals covered the expanse of the one-room carriage house. Even so, I felt the unrelenting pressure of my hip bone against the hardwood floor. How long would I have to lie like this? What is the acceptable length of time to seem open to experience while also preserving my dignity? It had been far too long since I'd been intimate with someone. At 44, I worried that I was becoming slightly feral. My parents, after 46 years of marriage, were still having sex. Postmenopausal, geriatric sex perhaps, but sex nonetheless. Meanwhile, I had just shelled out $25 to cuddle with a frail guy. During the introductions, our host had said, I started hosting cuddle parties 2 years ago because my touch tank was really low, but I knew I wasn't ready for dating. Her touch tank? As we went around the room, at least two people said their therapist had told them to try this, and one woman clutched her stuffed life-sized Garfield while rocking slightly and mumbling about being afraid of people. Years earlier, when I had a boyfriend and a constant supply of cuddles, I saw an advertisement for cuddle therapy and laughed. How sad, I thought. And yet, here I was, partly out of curiosity, partly to challenge myself to stay open to new and frightening things, and partly because I hope to meet someone. I am an independent, professional woman living in a progressive city, but entire days pass in which I do not touch another human being. I never thought I would be here, in this place, this time in my life. The fear that I'm in some way defective has become harder to stave off each year. A bell rang. Okay, that's 20 minutes, our host said, giving us an opportunity to rearrange and cuddle with new people. I wasted no time heading to the bathroom, the only space in this little house where I could be alone. When I emerged, everyone was partnered up. There was a tangle of bodies in the middle of the room. I stood in the kitchen contemplating the snacks. Dry shortbread cookies and veggies with ranch sauce. Unfortunately, no alcohol. That could turn things sexual, our host had explained. Cuddle parties are not about sex, but about setting boundaries and connecting. But even with the lights dimmed, the entire setup felt more clinical than connective, as if we were all enrolled in Human Interaction 101. I kept thinking about baby monkeys. In college, I took an intro to psychology course where we learned about Harry Harlow's experiments with rhesus monkeys and how the infant monkeys preferred a cloth mother to one made of wire and wood, even when the wire mother was the one supplying the food. Turns out primates prefer a cuddly fake mother to a fake mother who actually keeps them alive. Maybe this explains my recent craziness and blood pressure spikes. I had chalked it up to some sort of midlife crisis, but perhaps it's too many years of too little touch and affection. I needed to put myself out there, but the longer I avoided it, the more frightening the prospect became. I was less afraid of becoming a war correspondent than opening a Tinder account. Yet, somehow, I managed to corral enough bravery to do this. "Should we cuddle?" asked a buffed-out guy who had come in late. Sure, I said, since we were the only people not cuddling. "How about we spoon?" he asked. "Do you want to be Nevada or California?" "I'll be California," I said, wanting to control our proximity, and especially in our southern regions. But he didn't seem to want to get too close either, leaving at least 2 or 3 inches between us. I flung my arm over his side as we lay quietly, stiff as boards. And then he started his nervous chatter. "Yeah, I've seen these ads for cuddlers for hire," he said. "Seems like pretty easy money. I was thinking I could do that instead of what I'm doing now. I work in a hospital, but my boss hates me and she's stupid. Anyway, I told my therapist I was coming here tonight, and he said it's too soon." "Too soon for what?" I didn't dare ask. He continued chattering away until the host called time again. It feels like a weakness to admit I'm so lonely. I'm supposed to be a pioneer, a brave, single feminist and afraid to go it alone. Except when it's a Saturday night and I'm eating my dinner while staring out my window into the dining room of the family across from me. I watch the primates interact through their sliding glass doors. Father kisses mother on the neck while she washes dishes. Daughter number one sits on father's lap reading. Daughter number two hugs father around the neck. Do they watch me? Do they wonder? Why is the Arctic shrew feeding again? It's not that I haven't had opportunities. I've been engaged twice. The first time the man broke it off, the second time I did. But I've been deeply in love only once. My other relationships have been more like truces with loneliness. I pretend for months or years that I don't need a man to be happy. But is being smugly single any different from being smugly coupled? "Will you come and cuddle with us?" asked a woman who had been sensually cuddling with the same man all evening. She was maybe 10 or 15 years older than me, as was the gray-haired man with her. I was ready to leave, but I lay down on my back between them. He put his hand on my chest and his arm across my midsection. She started caressing my forearm, the way my mother used to. Soft fingernails against skin. I thought I might cry. Many of my single friends seem comfortable, even happy, alone. I'm too evolved for a relationship, one recently told me over a bottle of two-buck chuck. I nodded, pretending to understand. I moved to Seattle 11 years ago in search of love. In Alabama, it seemed as if everyone married by 30, but Seattle was full of 30-something singletons. Every party I attended held great possibility. And yet, most were stridently single, satisfied with their lives, climbing mountains, rowing across oceans. The less baggage, the better. The woman I had laid down by said, "We knew we wanted to cuddle with you when you were first introducing yourself and talking about how freaked out you are by all of this." Her hands were soft on my arm. "You were so honest and brave." When I asked if they knew each other before this evening, she laughed and told me they met 6 months ago at another cuddle party. A part of me hoped I would find love here. But as we went around the room introducing ourselves, I began to realize that I was possibly the most terrified person there. Maybe even more than the woman hugging Garfield. Over the years, almost without noticing, I had become less available, less accessible, walling off my heart brick by brick. The woman continued caressing my arm with one hand and then with the other, reached across my stomach to hold hands with her man. We seemed to be on the precipice of orgy territory. Instead of freaking out, though, I actually let myself relax. And as the places where our bodies were touching warmed, I began to feel physically connected to other people for the first time in a long time. Why had I been so frightened of this? Why is anyone? There are now more single adults than married ones in this country. And the number of us living alone has increased to a quarter of all households. It shouldn't require scientific research with monkeys to understand that we need, perhaps above all else, physical comfort in this world. My resolution for 2017? Seek it.
That's Margarita LaViva reading Christine Lloyd's essay, In the New Year, More Cuddling. Margarita says that watching so many of her single friends looking for love, and having been there many times herself, helped her connect with this essay.
I really get it, and I really get how much we need human contact and how, especially living in big cities, we can get so lost. And I really connected with the loneliness of this woman and the reading the part about her almost crying when the woman caressed her arm. It really got me. I know what that feels like, and I do think we're humans, and human connection and human touch is massively important, and without it, not only are we starved physically, but then I think we become starved emotionally, and at least in my world, I think the soul dies a little bit.
Thanks very much to Margarita LaViva for reading this essay. She stars in HBO's The Deuce. Christine Lloyd says that in 2017, she took steps towards achieving her resolution to seek out touch, but she didn't quite meet the goal she set for herself.
I feel that that resolution really set the bar high, and that to me, it sort of meant, okay, you know, in 2017, I'm going to have a relationship. By the end of the year, I'm going to be in a relationship, and it's going to be awesome. You know, that's sometimes how I talk myself up for things. But you know, that hasn't happened. And partly, again, because I'm sort of backing into a fear corner. But I'm moving toward that ever so tortoise-like. You know, I'm starting to get on dating sites, which, oh, dear God, don't even get me started about that. But, you know, I'm dipping the toes in. I'm you know, getting there.
Among her 2018 resolutions, dating more. And she's also open to attending another cuddle party, this time with a different perspective than she had the first time around.
I definitely went feeling like, this is sad. This is so sad that I'm going to this place where people have to go to get touch and to get cuddled. And so I was very judgmental going into it. And that kind of judgment is such a layer of protection, right? I didn't want to see myself as part of that group, and I didn't want to identify with the people there. I thought, oh, I'm so friendly and extroverted, and I don't need this. I'm just checking it out. But, you know, by the end, I really did see that it was helping people, you know, and I would like to go back and just kind of experience it again now that I'm not as fearful and maybe a little bit more open to the experience from the beginning.
And Christine believes cuddle parties can help, at least a little, in addressing a real problem.
You know, I don't know that the touch that's brief that we get from a friend or a physician or a massage therapist is enough. Maybe it's what's going to have to do for those of us who aren't in a partnership at the moment. But, you know, you really do long for and miss that, you know, the holding, you know, someone holding you for a long period of time. And it's kind of weird to ask a stranger to do that. You know, it's kind of, you sort of have to skip over any kind of building of a relationship and just have this intimacy with someone who you're never going to be intimate with. So it's very odd in that sense.
She also wants people listening to understand both that it's okay to be alone and that it can be hard.
I wish people felt like it was okay to express that and to feel that way and to know that they're not alone in feeling lonely and that there are things that they can do about it, whether it's going to a cuddle party or getting a massage or going to a meetup group and interacting with strangers, you know, talking about something they're passionate about. I think that the longer we hole up and feel lonely, the harder it is to get out, right? The longer you don't do something, the scarier and harder it seems. And I think that's, I guess, the other thing is just to be brave. And it's scary when you're lonely and alone to be brave because you don't have that bolstering force of a best friend who's going to go do that thing with you. But you can do it.
That's Christine Lloyd. She's a writer and librarian living in Seattle. Next week on Modern Love, Gillian Anderson.
The memo from the middle school came home in my daughter's backpack on a Friday afternoon. Next week, your sixth grade child will participate in a flower sack baby exercise. All sixth graders were to report to school Monday with 5-pound bags of flour dressed up as dolls and carry them everywhere for the week. The idea was to teach them the responsibilities of teenage parenthood.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Perotti. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.